You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, I hope you are well tryptophan. It's the, for those of you not in the know, the amino acid and principal supply in turkey. Welcome. Happy Monday. Tom Hartman here with you. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Major victory for the Occupy movements over the weekend so far. Now, we'll see how this all plays out, but I would say no matter what happens, this was still a major victory, in particular in Los Angeles, Occupy LA. And just a shout out to the DUers who are there, Firewalk with me, Pinboy, PYNboy, and Coalition, and apparently a couple of others, and listeners to this program who I know are down there at the Occupy LA movement. And if anybody wants to call in and give us an update, feel free. The number, of course, 866-987-THOM. But here's what happened. The mayor basically said, okay, midnight Sunday, you guys are out of here. And it's going to be like New York. We're going to take everything down. And so midnight Sunday, thousands of people showed up across from City Hall in downtown Los Angeles and said, we're standing here with the Occupy people. And the police said, don't think we're going to do this. So it's still a fluid situation, but just the fact that frankly, I doubt this was just a police tactical decision. This had to be also a mayor's office political decision. The fact that the power structure, that the institutional power structure is saying, okay, that's not the way to go. We're not going to create more Oakland martyrs. We're not going to, we're going to work this thing out. Now, an interesting dimension to this. And by the way, the news coming out about what we are learning from this Fed audit that Bernie Sanders got and Dennis Kucinich got forced into the last budget, where we now know that the Fed loaned $7.7 trillion. I'm going to get into that in some further detail a little farther down the road. But bottom line, the crimes of the banksters are becoming more and more and more apparent. And the absolutely righteous rage of the people, whether it's in the Tea Party movement or in the Occupy movement, because increasingly I think that the Tea Party movement in the press has basically become Dick Armey and Grover Norquist and, a few multimillionaires and the front groups for the Koch brothers that they fund. And they call themselves the Tea Party, and they're members of Congress who are now sucking down money from lobbyists like there's no tomorrow. But the actual people on the ground, more or less, are showing up along with the Occupy folks and saying, yeah, hey, we were mad as hell about the banksters, and we still are. I don't care what you call it. But the question is, who are the police? Are they part of the 99 or are they part of the systemic structural power system that has been defending the private, corporate, for-profit banksters against we the people, against individual citizens? I mean, look at the mortgages, look at the foreclosures and so on, and the crimes and the robo-signers. I mean, now you've got the Attorney General of California saying, no, I'm not going to go along with this deal that the Obama administration and 48 other states apparently, and I've been trying to figure out if Eric Schneiderman in New York is going along with this or not, but they're trying to do this deal where the banksters pay some 23 or 25 billion bucks that goes to make whole a few of the people who got screwed by the robo-signing. Keep in mind, this robo-signing, first of all, there's no robots involved. They were hiring people for like $8 an hour to sign thousands of documents an hour over a phony name and signing them as vice president of the bank, certifying that the bank actually owned that property. Okay, this is a crime. It's called forgery. Arguably, it's called fraud because it's a crime that involves banking. And it's a crime that was perpetrated against millions of American citizens. And so the deal that the administration and the states are trying to work out with the banksters is you guys pay some chump change. The Treasury gives them $7 trillion. That's 7,000 billion. 7.7 trillion, actually. In secret money that we didn't even know about. I mean, you know, TARP, everybody's fighting over. So anyhow, we'll give you $7 trillion. You pay $25 billion, which is like chump change. It's like, we'll give you $700 million. You pay 25 cents to make whole a few of these people so we can have, you know, some nice photo ops or something, people getting their houses back, whatever. And we won't send you to jail. Now, you tell me this isn't insane? That there isn't something just fundamentally wrong with this? So anyhow, people are getting it. And the question that they're asking is, when they go out and they protest against these crimes that the banksters committed, in many cases with the complicity of politicians in both parties, although virtually 100% of the Republican Party. I mean, this was the Bush bailout, right? This was the Fed under Bush that did this. Dodd-Frank made things, you know, moving into the Democratic administration made things a lot better, but we still don't have Glass-Steagall back. So the question, who are the police? And I thought, you know, David Graeber, who we did a Conversations with Great Minds conversation with a month or so ago. And if you go to conversationswithgreatminds.com, you can see this half-hour-long conversation that I had with David Graeber, a professor of anthropology at Yale University. And he said, when we are dealing with the police as an institutional structure, we are not dealing with a group of individuals acting on their own personal feelings and judgments, but rather a group of functionaries who have part of the terms of their jobs agreed to set their personal opinions and feelings aside and instead act as obedient agents of the state. Thus, if we're referring to the police as an institution rather than the personal feelings of the individual police, no, they are not part of the 99%. They are the enforcers of the power of the 1%. But if they're backing down, then maybe they're getting it that they're part of the 99%, or maybe not. I thought it was really interesting. We had on the show last Wednesday, we had the Ray, what was his last name? In any case, he was on. He was the police officer who got arrested at Occupy Wall Street in New York, who said that a former police captain, retired police captain from Philly, as I recall, who said that the way you talk to police, he said they can't establish eye contact with you. They can't talk back to you because they've been trained not to do that. That's how people distract the police while somebody else is trying to commit a crime. But he said they are hearing you. So when you talk to police, tell them, hey, we know that you're just doing your job. You're just like me. You're an average guy. You're making an average salary. You know, please be decent to us, that kind of thing. So there's like, you know, there's this human element, but there's also, I mean, there were individual humans clearing out the Warsaw Ghetto, right? And at a certain point, this groupthink sets in. It's like the hive. And that's what what we have to avoid in the United States. We have to work to make sure that we all get it, that it's all of us. That it's a we society, not a me society, and not an us versus them society. So how do we do that?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And in particular, how do we do that in the face of right-wing talk radio and GOP TV, a.k.a. Fox News, try to make it a us versus them society?
Through the rain.
Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Dorley Rainey is on the line with us. She is the 84-year-old activist who was pepper sprayed in Seattle famously last week. And her website, she blogs over at oldladyincombatboots.com, which is a fascinating blog. Dorley, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. I am so happy to be on your program. What an honor. Thank you.
Well, thank you for being here with us. It's an honor to speak with you. First of all, obligatorily we should revisit what happened to you in Seattle, but I would like to go a little beyond that, because reading your blog, there's obviously so much more to what you're doing and to your activism. But first of all, just what happened that thrust you into the spotlight here?
Well, I just happened to be by where Occupy Seattle was doing a solidarity event in solidarity with Occupy Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just standing around talking to my friends in Occupy Seattle. And after a while, the police said, you have to move out, and they picked up their bicycles and started pushing us into a small circle and then started to pepper spray all of us. The thing that is interesting to me is there are very few policemen in Seattle who don't know me from other events, and not all of them protest, just seeing them on the street and stuff. They know who I am.
Did any of the people who pepper sprayed you know who you were? Did you recognize
people? Yes, I am sure they are.
That's remarkable. I was talking before the break about how this, you know, on the one hand, many of these police officers are just average people in their real lives, and they're not all that well paid. And on the other hand, you get the uniform and the kind of hive mentality, and they almost become something else. We certainly see this in war. And, you know, we certainly saw this in Mussolini's Italy and Franco's Spain and Hitler's Germany. And was your sense that these were, you know, individuals who were, you know, very, very reluctant to be doing what they were doing, or were they enthusiastic about it?
They were very casual about it. It's just the day at the office. That's the kind of attitude I found.
That's unfortunate.
It was uncalled for.
Yeah.
And the bicycles, when they bring the bicycles up and push people, there's always the danger that somebody falls. And then when people get pushed some more, they fall over each other, and then you get damages beyond pepper spray.
Sure, sure. Have you recovered from being pepper sprayed?
I still have a cough, and I don't know if you can tell by my voice. I still don't talk the way I used to.
Yeah, because the stuff got down into your lungs.
Yes, and I really do believe that what they used was a much more advanced form of pepper spray than what they used in other assaults on humanity. Mm. I heard that in Egypt they're using a specially designed pepper spray by an American manufacturer.
Right.
I spoke to other people who still have after effects after 2 weeks almost.
Oh, my goodness. So, and your blog, Old Lady in Combat Boots, you're 84 years old. At what point in your life did you decide that you were going to be a political activist? I mean, is this something that goes back to your youth, or is this relatively recent?
Well, I think I've always had problems with unearned authority.
Mm-hmm.
This business that you have respect for somebody just because they wear a uniform has never resonated with me.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever things go wrong here in this city, I write letters to people, and I've been involved in doing the program for the big anti-war marches and the big rallies that we had when the Iraq War started.
Right.
And I've been involved in homeless projects here in town. And I can feel the pain of the citizens who feel that they are never heard by whatever government. It starts with the dog catcher.
Yeah, It's
up to the president. They do not listen.
Yeah, it's so true. We're talking with Doralee Rainey, the 84-year-old activist who was pepper sprayed in Seattle. Doralee, forgive my inability to do fast subtraction. What year were you born?
In 1926.
Okay, so if you were born in 26, you must recall the Great Depression and its aftermaths. I'm curious, and we just have 1 minute left. I'm so very sorry. I'm curious if you think that we are in a place now that is similar to that time.
Well, I really don't know much about the Great Depression. I was born in 26. I was 5, 6 years old in the early 30s. So I don't know whether it was my family shielded us from the effects. I know that they were telling stories about going to the bread store with a wheelbarrow full of money to buy one roll.
Yeah,
and those stories I heard. This is a completely different recession.
Yeah.
This is man-made.
Yeah,
it has been brought onto us by the conglomerates, by the outsourcing. It has been brought to us by ConAgra, who do the Roundup Ready.
Yep. I get it. Doralee, I'm sorry we're out of time, but you said it very, very well, and I think you're so right. OldLadyInCombatBoots.com is where Doralee blogs. Doralee, thank you, Rainey. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you.
It's an honor talking with you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And meanwhile, in Kansas, Emma Sullivan is saying to Sam Brownback, nah, not going to apologize.
So many people speaking out now are getting busted by the cops. Pepper sprayed and slammed down hard, but their voices will not be stopped. The revolution will not be televised, but it's alive and kicking online. Forget Fox and the major networks. They're way behind the times. It's Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. Videos, blogs, and texts. From cell phones, webcams, laptops, and who knows what's coming next.
The revolution. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, that's why that's been up there. Our crazy alert for the day. This is incredible. A fellow by the name of Phillips, or a family by the name of Phillips, Mr. Phillips, I guess a fellow by the name of Phillips, applied to U.S. Bank for a modification of his mortgage down in Georgia. And the U.S. bank said, no, we're not going to modify your mortgage. And so he said, why? You know, am I not credit worthy? And the U.S. bank said, we simply choose not to do it. So he sued them. And the judge, Judge Blackmun, in the court says, and I quote, he said, this court cannot imagine why U.S. bank will not make known to Mr. Phillips, a taxpayer, how his numbers put him outside the federal guidelines to receive a loan modification. And then he goes on to say, he says, taking $20 billion of taxpayer money was no problem for U.S. Bank. A cynical judge might believe that this entire motion to dismiss is a desperate attempt to avoid a discovery period where U.S. Bank would have to tell Mr. Phillips how his financial situation does not qualify him for a modification. Excuse me. And then the judge says, with apologies to folk singer Arlo Guthrie, he said, why doesn't the bank say so? In other words, tell why Mr. Phillips shouldn't be modified. With mathematic equations, pie charts, and bar graphs, all on 8x10 glossy paper, circles and arrows, and paragraphs on the back explaining each winning number.
Man came in, said, all rise. We all stood up, and Obie stood up with the 27 8x10 covered glossy pictures, and the judge walked in, sat down with the CNI dog, and he sat down. Obie looked at the CNI dog. And then the 27 8x10 covered glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one and began to cry, because Obie came to the realization that it was a typical case of American blind justice.
Yeah, well, that was a different story. But there you go. So anyhow, the judge says, I don't see why you can't have mathematic equations, pie charts, and bar graphs all on 8x10 glossy color photo paper with circles and arrows and paragraphs on the back explaining each winning number. He says, maybe U.S. Bank no longer has any of the $20 billion left. And so their lack of written explanation, see, this judge didn't have a senile dog. This judge could actually read these things. And so their lack of written explanation might be attributed to some kind of ink reduction program to save money. Clearly, U.S. Bank cannot take the money, contract with our government to provide a service to the taxpayer, violate that agreement. He's talking about $20 billion from TARP money. And then say no one on earth can sue them for it. That's not the law in Georgia. As R. Gritz Groceries notes over at Democratic Underground, now that was a smackdown. It's a great crazy alert, too. Okay, Alex in Santa Cruz, California. Alex, it says you disagree with me. You go to the front of the line. What's up?
I don't necessarily disagree with you, but I want to talk about a personal experience, and it's kind of an antidote, and this is what I get a lot from my conservative colleagues and friends. Those people who took out equity lines of credits, you know, mortgages, second mortgages on their houses, wasn't that their own fault, realizing, and they should have realized that there was a housing bubble and that it was going
to... So they should have gone to college and studied economics and studied the South Sea bubble and the Dutch tulip bubble and the housing bubble of 1922 to 26, and they should have been able to see that this was bubble behavior and not participated in it, and damn them for not taking an economics course. And by the way, I would submit to you that most professors of economics in this country did not see this coming.
Well, I saw it coming, and my wife and I took out a home equity line of credit. We borrowed we took out $40,000 on our mortgage, and we had a baby, and I went to school. I have a brother who has a MBA, and he told us that there was a housing bubble and it was going to explode, and so we sold our house at the top of the market. But I'm just telling you that this is the conservative mind frame. They boil
right.
it down to just
no,
an
I,
individual
all these...
level, and individuals make individual decisions,
yeah.
and we can't look at it any other way. And
which is nonsense, and B, here's a statistic for your conservative friends. 50%, fully 50%, actually it's slightly more than that. I think it's 52-53% of all the people. Now, you know the difference between a prime mortgage and a subprime mortgage.
Yeah.
You know, prime mortgage is like, you know, low interest rate, fixed rate, 20, 30 years. You know what you're going to pay forever, and it's solid. And it's the subprime mortgages were like the adjustable rate mortgages where they could go up. The banks could pull them. They were subject to all these weird terms, and they were very, very profitable. Didn't make as much money in the first few months. They were like, you know, these teaser rates that credit card companies offer. 52-53% of all the people who received subprime mortgages actually qualified for prime mortgages. In other words, they would not be in trouble right now, but they were not informed of that by the banksters, because the banksters made so much more money off the subprime mortgages. So this was clearly a crime, and it wasn't a crime committed by people who were stupid enough or unfortunate enough not to have either A, studied economics, or B, in your case, having a brother who's an MBA. These were people who were victims of a system that was systematically corrupt and was looting the United States of America while the times were good.
Right, and another point I want to bring up is, if conservatives and Republicans have such a negative view towards human nature and that we're all evil, why do they cherry pick and take exception to the fact that we don't need government regulation when it comes to bad guys or guys on Wall Street doing bad things with the home mortgage economy? I mean, if there's no regulation, if we're all evil, we're all going to do self-interest and bad things are going to happen.
Yeah, there's a little bit of internal contradiction in that, because along with that comes the notion, the conservative notion is that we're all evil, but the libertarian notion is that if everybody just lets the free market take over, everything will be wonderful. And what they forget is that power, nature, abhors a vacuum. And that if government steps out of an area of governance, for example, if in baseball all the umpires said, we're going to tear up the rule books and start ignoring the rules, somebody else will step in. And in the case of government, when the government regulators step out, the big corporations step in and they basically take things over, and you end up with monopolies and these disasters. But, you know, yeah, you're absolutely right. And this was a classic case. Phil Graham was the man largely responsible for it. The Graham-Leach-Bliley Bill Act and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act that was promoted by his wife, Wendy, that he helped write. And she was at that time on the board of directors of Enron. And this contained the so-called Enron loophole that basically allowed for trading of, quote, commodities on, quote, dark exchanges, now, these unregulated exchanges. It was illegal before 1999, hadn't happened ever in the United States. And then it got legalized, and then financial instruments, things like mortgages, got considered commodities, whereas before they were not considered commodities, or at least the derivatives of them were not considered commodities. And so they could be traded. And so we went from zero to $800 trillion worth of these bets on bets on bets, these derivatives based on these bad subprime mortgages that shouldn't have been sold in the first place, not necessarily bought, but sold. And you know, this was all the result of deregulation. And I find it tragic that Barney Frank has announced that he's going to resign. Thank you for the call, Alec. I find it tragic that Barney Frank has said he's going to resign from the House of Representatives and not run for reelection, because, I mean, I realize he's a lightning rod. He's a lightning rod because he is so right. He's been so right on all of these things. It's just mind-boggling. Dave in Detroit. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Well, I was just listening earlier, and, you know, with all this financial discussion, is anybody – what was – Alan Greenspan's role in this whole thing? I mean, nobody even sits there and questions his involvement or says, geez, I wonder what his attitude was or what was.
Well, actually, Congress did question that, and he was called to testify before Congress. I mean, first of all, Bernie Sanders had been harassing him quarterly, you know, when he came in and spoke in front of the Budget Committee in the Senate, but even back in the House. I mean, I've got some old audio around here someplace. Jacob can probably dig it out. It's about a minute and a half where Bernie Sanders is just reaming, Greenspan. Yeah. I'm trying to remember the year. I think it was like 4 years ago. I mean, it was before the crash. But after the crash, Greenspan came out and said that his numbers were, his understanding was wrong. His philosophy of deregulation was wrong. So he basically apologized in front of all of us for this. But in the meantime, what the Fed was doing was passing out $7.7 trillion in loans to U.S. banks and a total of $12 trillion in loans, which included U.S. corporations, foreign corporations, and wealthy individuals, some of whom were not even citizens. And this is what, you know, Bernie Sanders has come out and shown us. And that's, you know, Alan Greenspan was drinking the Ayn Rand Kool-Aid. There's just no other way to describe it. And it's a tragedy, but that's what was going on. So, Dave, thanks for the call. Frank in Seal Beach, just a minute to go here till the break. Frank, a quick one?
Yeah, Tom, thanks for taking my call. Question for you. From what I understand, when they're talking about taxing millionaires and billionaires, right, you hear this on the radio all
right.
the time from the Dems and the Republicans, we're talking about annual income, right? Not assets.
That's correct. And in fact, the tax doesn't even kick in until you've made $1 million. So you pay the additional half a percent tax, the additional, you know, 5 cents on a dollar or $10, whatever. You know, you pay that additional half a percent tax on the millionth and oneth dollar, a million and first dollar. See, that's right. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Amazing. And I still have to tell you about Emma Sullivan and what she has said to Governor Sam Brownback of Kansas. Thank you very much, Governor. No.
You got no time for the messenger. Got no regard for the thing that you don't understand. You got no fear of the underdog. That's why you will not survive.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And a quick update from Mark in Seattle. Hey, Mark, what's going on with Seattle, Occupy Seattle?
Hey, Tom. Mark Taylor Canfield. It was good to hear Dorley Rainey on the radio. She's my hero. I'm proud to say I got pepper sprayed standing right next to her.
Oh, my.
But what's happening is we're down in Olympia today because the governor has called a special session in Olympia. And mainly so that they can cut the social services and education budgets to the bone. Mm-hmm. So we've got people coming from all over the state to try to stop these budget cuts and put some pressure on the state legislature. And at the same time that this is happening in Olympia, there's also a court battle going on between Occupy Seattle and the Seattle Central Community College, where our camp is at. They're actually trying to change the laws or the rules regarding camping on the campus. Mm-hmm. According to the state law, there is no prohibition on camping at a state campus.
Right.
They're trying to change that law. They had an emergency meeting with the Board of Trustees the other day, and Occupy Seattle has actually got a court date today at 2 p.m. to file a restraining order and ask a judge to intervene and stop the eviction. All right. So we'll see how that goes.
That's very interesting. Or an injunction? Yeah. That's great. Mark, thank you for the update.
No problem, Tom. Thank you.
Okay, good talking with you. Jacob, you've got this audio. Is the year on that, is that part of the file? 2003. Okay, now just tell me this isn't prescient. This is Senator this is actually at the time it was Representative Bernie Sanders in the House of Representatives. This was the year that Bernie started, I believe this was the year that he started doing our show every Friday. And he was on the House Budget Committee, and he's got Alan Greenspan in front of him. 2003. Keep in mind, this was as the housing bubble was really starting to blow up, and everybody should have been looking around going, whoa, what's going on? 3 years after Phil Gramm got through, Gramm, Leach, Bliley, and 2 years after, or 4 years after, 3 years after he got through the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, the economy is going into major bubble mode. Our jobs are going overseas. Alan Greenspan is chairman of the Fed, and here's what Bernie Sanders had to say to him and what Greenspan said in response. Fire it.
Now, Mr. Greenspan, representing the CEOs of America and the wealthiest people of America, you consistently come in here every year and you tell us how great the economy is doing, and you tell us how great unfettered free trade is. So that's a crisis I want to talk about. Talk about unfettered free trade that you have been supporting for years. We now have a record-breaking trade deficit of $618 billion. We have a trade deficit with China alone of $160 billion,
which
has gone up by 30% in the last year. There are economists who tell us that trade deficit is going to go up and up and up. People who go Christmas shopping understand that when they walk into a store, virtually everything on their shelves is made in China now. You have the heads of large information technology companies in America who basically are telling us, hey, we ain't going to have information technology in America, no longer white-collar jobs, because in 10 or 20 years, China is going to be the information technology center of the world. The economists tell us we have lost millions of decent-paying jobs. We have lost 16% of our manufacturing sector in the last 4 years alone, and we're going to lose more and more white-collar jobs to China. And yet, year after year, people like you come here.
This was 2003, remember.
Unfettered free trade, it's just great. Question, Mr. Greenspan, after record-breaking trade deficits, the loss of blue-collar jobs, the beginning hemorrhaging of white-collar information technology jobs, the understanding that if we don't change things, China is going to be the economic superpower of this world in the next 15 or so years, have you rethought your views on unfettered free trade?
That's 2003.
All I can say to you, Congressman, is that in spite of the forecast of the economists that you're citing, of which I can find a whole slew who will report exactly the opposite, we have nonetheless created the highest standard of living of a major industrial economy in this world.
Really?
We have.
Oh, really?
That's what the facts are. The question of increasing globalization, for which the trade deficit is a symptom, is something we should be pleased about, not concerned about, because a considerable amount of our real wealth creation, our real income creation, for this a broad spectrum of our society, even including the problem which I happen to agree with on the issue of undesirable increase in concentration, despite that, we still have the most prosperous nation in the world.
Are you telling us that we should see as a positive thing a record-breaking $618 billion trade deficit and the loss of 3 million manufacturing jobs in the last 4 years? That's a positive thing?
Our unemployment rate is 5.2%.
But the new jobs that are being created are low-wage jobs with minimal benefits.
Again,
and
this
we are
is
losing
2003.
That is not factually
really?
Correct, Congressman. I'm sorry, that is not what the facts are.
Well, you tell, you know, maybe, Mr. Greenspan, one of the problems we have is you talk to CEOs, I talk to working people. And what working people tell me is they are losing good-paying jobs. Parents are worried about the fact they're sending their kids to college now. for information technology jobs. Those jobs are going to China. You're telling me we're creating good-paying jobs with good benefits.
I'm telling you that I don't listen to the anecdotal stuff by itself. I look at the statistics, and the statistics tell us that we are getting job expansion fairly much across.
Don't worry, be happy. This is Alan Greenspan in 2003 being grilled by then-Congressman Bernie Sanders in the House Budget Committee saying, Bernie saying, Mr. Greenspan, look at these numbers. We're headed for a disaster. There's a cliff coming up. And Greenspan's going, hey, let's put some more pedal to the metal. We're having a fine time here. Hey, it's a party. It's only 5.3% unemployment. Things are going great. And guess who was right? I think, you know, history kind of demonstrates who was right. It's not like Greenspan wasn't warned. It's not like George Bush wasn't warned. It's not like the whole Republican establishment. It's not like the country wasn't warned, for goodness sakes. I've been ranting about that on this radio program, and not just me, for 5 years, saying, you know, get out of the stock market. This thing is going to crash.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. In our previous hour, Dorley Rainey dropped by. We had an interesting conversation. The 84-year-old activist, oldladyincombatboots.com, who was pepper sprayed in Seattle. We got a report from Occupy Seattle. We've been talking about the Wall Street banks and how they earned actually billions of profits and $7.7 trillion of money that was secretly given to them by the Fed that we wouldn't even know about if it wasn't for Bernie Sanders. Played a clip from 2003. The year that Bernie started doing a weekly town hall meeting on this show every Friday back in 2003, where he was raking Alan Greenspan over the coals for his embrace of free trade policies and his embrace of the growing bubble. Tell me he wasn't prescient. And Greenspan's like, oh, no, everything's fine. Unemployment's only 5.2%. We got a great economy. We're creating wonderful new jobs. Everything's don't worry. Be happy. And Bernie is like, but I am worried. So we're going to, you know, and also this Emma Sullivan has told, she is an 18-year-old high school student in Kansas who tweeted that Governor Brownback blows. And apparently his office contacted the principal's office, who contacted her and said, you will apologize on Monday. And she's saying, no, don't think so. Don't think so at all. And, in fact, at Tom_Hartman is now following at EmmaKate988. You can read all about it. John Nichols is on the line with us, the Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, thenation.com. Big goings on in Wisconsin. John, welcome back to the program. John? John appears to have vanished. Okay. We'll catch up with John. So anyway, that's I'll give you a quick summary of what's going on in Wisconsin. What's going on in Wisconsin is they've hit the halfway point in the number of signatures that they need to get in order to put on the ballot the recall of Governor Scott Walker. And I mean, this is just like you know, Senate Bill 5 in Ohio. It's like it's happening so fast. And it's happening so good. And it's and according to John, it's happening in very Republican areas. So anyway, a lot going on with that. And this situation in Kansas, this is so strange. This is so strange. Oh, the other thing that I forgot to tell you about is that we covered in the first hour, I just want to touch upon one more time, is this major victory in Los Angeles. We'll get back to that in just a second. But John, this time when I say John Nichols, is there a John Nichols there?
I sure hope so.
Yeah. Hey, how you doing?
I'm so sorry, Tom. It's I listened to all of your fabulous intro and all the details and information. I was learning things left and right, and then suddenly I was out of the conversation.
Oh, that's strange.
It must be how a smart person who goes to Washington feels.
Yeah, out of the conversation. Yes.
Yeah. Or a Republican debate.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me about what's going on in Wisconsin.
Well, there's huge stuff going on, Tom, and it's just absolutely heartening and remarkable at the same time. As you indicated, it hasn't been officially released, but the groups that are running the recall in Wisconsin are doing their tabulations from the first 2 weeks. Remember, tonight at midnight will mark 2 weeks from the start of the drive to recall Governor Scott Walker. And when the final numbers come in, we'll see where it's at. But it looks to be that they have collected in the range of 250,000 to roughly 270,000 signatures. It'll be someplace in that range. And remember that 270,000 is half of the official total required to put the recall on the ballot.
Right, although you've got to overshoot that considerably to take out dupes and people who aren't actually registered to vote.
Of course. And you know that United Wisconsin, the group that's been running this, has been they've been taking the signatures as they come in and analyzing them. They're not just piling them up in a corner and saying, oh, we've got all these. So they're actually taking dupes out as this goes along. But you're right that they want to overshoot. What is significant about the number that has been collected so far, whatever the precise number that we find out later this evening is, what is significant about it is that to do that in 2 weeks and before this drive has actually begun, a lot of the aggressive door-to-door and, kind of coordinated signature gathering that will come as it goes along, suggests that, A, it's very likely they get their number, and B, it's very likely that they overshoot rather dramatically. And I'll give you a comparison that becomes useful. I talked to some of the Ohio folks who did their veto referendum petition drive, and they filed 1.3 million signatures there. We looked at what their rate of signature gathering was in Ohio, and at this point in Wisconsin, the rate is almost double what it was in Ohio.
Whoa.
Now
some of that might have...
They're going to get 2 million here, but yeah. I'm telling you that...
Well, I understand, though, that the Republicans, or at least one right-wing talk show host up in Wisconsin, was screaming and complaining loudly that your people were out there on Black Friday when there are these huge concentrations of people at the shopping centers, and therefore,
shopping, Tom.
Yeah, therefore the numbers were on steroids. It seems like a good thing to me.
Well, here's the interesting thing. They weren't just out there on Black Friday. This is the really fascinating and I think important backstory on all this. On Thanksgiving morning, my daughter and I ran the Turkey Trot in Burlington, Wisconsin. That's a run where 500 people go out and do a four-mile run to raise money for charity. And when we showed up at 7:30 to do the run, there was along the parking lot where people came in, a bunch of trucks were arrayed with their recall Walker signs, and people were out gathering signatures.
Mm-hmm.
In Burlington, Wisconsin, a very conservative town, a town that voted for John McCain for president, and they were mobbed. They had folks gathered around them. And so it isn't just Black Friday that folks are out. This recall drive, which is driven by volunteers, has an energy and a presence that I've never seen before.
That's great. That is absolutely great. Well, John, thank you for checking in with us. This is the essence of the story you want to share, right?
Well, it is. And I think one other thing I would add, Tom, that's very important is that these numbers that are going to be reflected as the day goes on are going to be coming disproportionately from rural areas. The striking...
Largely Republican areas.
There are the counties that are actually exceeding their goals, that are going way ahead, tend to be rural, Republican-leaning areas that send Republicans to the legislature. That doesn't mean that the urban areas aren't turning in more numbers, but what it does mean is that when this map is drawn, you will see a remarkable representation from across the state. Not just Madison, not just, a liberal ward in Milwaukee, but the whole of Wisconsin.
Right.
And I think that that's the thing that you get from that is that that poll you saw about a week and a half ago from Wisconsin Public Radio that suggested you had this 58% supporting recall, that seemed like such a high number, and yet as you see where these signatures are coming in, it's quite clear that there are people around the state in unexpected places.
Could it be, John, and we just have a few seconds left, but could it be that Republicans are supporting the recall not because they disagree with his ideology, but because they think he's been an incompetent governor and they're offended by things like his taking a phony phone call from the Koch brothers?
That's a little part of it, but I think there's something else, too. Last month, the state of Illinois, our neighboring state, which we often compete with, added 30,000 jobs, whereas Wisconsin lost 9,700 jobs.
Uh-huh.
It's a pure economic frustration.
Right. The wonders of austerity, yes. Yeah. Okay, all right. John Nichols with The Nation, thenation.com. John, always great talking with you.
Great talking
Thanks
to
for
you.
Checking in with us, and my apologies for our phone system going kaflooey on you. We'll be right back. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Major victory in Los Angeles for the Occupy movement.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And what does it mean for the future of the Occupy movement? Stick around. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. And, boy, what a remarkable week. What a remarkable year. Newt Gingrich gets the endorsement of the Manchester Union leader. It's just incredible. It's just absolutely incredible. Chris in New Jersey. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I'd like to get back to what you were talking about, Bernie Sanders and Alec Greenspan. But Bernie Sanders isn't the only one that's been talking about this for a long time. Ron Paul also has.
Yep.
And he's been talking about, basically word for word the things you've been talking about the past hour. And there's actually videos on the YouTube of him debating the Federal Reserve governor back in 1983.
Yep.
But I like your listeners to check out something that Alan Greenspan actually wrote back in 1966, which actually backs Ron Paul a lot of what he says, called golden economic freedom. And he basically talks about that in the absence of the gold standard, there's no way to protect savings from confiscation through inflation. And that's one of the big things that Ron Paul talks about is the inflation tax. It's not really a tax, but it's there.
Yeah.
And it hurts people very badly, and it could be found in all aspects of life, and especially the things that the government gets involved in, because the government has the ability to just print or borrow or tax money. To basically
the Fed actually has...
The more money that it dumps into a certain area...
No, you're right, and the Fed actually has inflation goals. They actually have a goal of keeping...
Those numbers have been skewed also.
No, but I'm agreeing with you. I'm not disagreeing with you. By the Fed having an inflation goal of 2% or 3% and not above that, but let's keep it at that. What they're basically saying is that the government gets to borrow money by issuing bonds now, and in 20 years when they pay it back, it will the actual value of those dollars will have been decreased by 3% every year over a 20-year period, which adds up to more than 60%.
A lot, that's a lot.
Because it's compounding, and or it's the equivalent of compound interest. So yeah, I'm with you, and I'm not a fan of the gold standard, but I'm with you that setting these kinds of inflationary goals. Thank you for making the call. The problem with Ron Paul is that he doesn't understand that nature abhors a vacuum. That if you say we are no longer going to regulate business in America, we're no longer going to regulate the oil industry. We're not capturing the externalities of the oil industry. We're not, they're not paying for the cancers they cause. They're not paying for the asthmas they cause. They're not paying for the pollution that they cause, by and large. I mean, the pollution that literally comes out of your tailpipe. They're not paying for any of that. They're not paying for the ozone. They're not paying for the cost of global warming. They're not paying for the tornado in Joplin, Missouri. They're not paying for the extreme weather events. They're paying nothing for any of that. They have succeeded in shifting the externalities, the costs of carbon-based fuels. And it's not just the oil industries, the oil, coal, and gas industries. They've succeeded in shifting all those costs onto us, and then on top of that, they're getting subsidies from us. Now, Ron Paul would be with you and me in saying they shouldn't be getting subsidies from us. But when you talk about, hey, let's recover those externalities, Ron Paul's not there on that. And this is my concern. This is the sociopathic worldview. Ayn Rand, Jacob, did you ever get the whole clip? To the very end with that Ayn Rand clip. Did you get the very end of it? No, you didn't. Okay. I'll have to share it with you tomorrow. I've got it at home. I have a and thanks to Roy for sending it to us. a clip of, you know, I think it was Morley Safer was interviewing Ayn Rand, and this is in Adam Curtis's new documentary from the BBC, and he says, you know, what happens when you die? You know, you're not, you know, he was talking about her atheism, basically. And she's like, you know, he's like, you're not going to be around to worry about it anyway, right? And she said, no, actually, she said that she agrees with a philosopher whose name she could not remember. And I wonder if it was, you know, Wayne Edward Hickman, the mass murderer who she so adored. But anyhow, she says, actually, what I think is going on is, this is what she said, is that it's not that I cease, she said, it's not that she ceases when she dies, but that the world ends when she dies. Now think about that for a minute. This is the psychology that has been driving much of the politics in the United States for, frankly, centuries, but in particular since the Reagan era for the last 30 years. You know, Franklin Roosevelt, when he became president, we shifted away from that psychology and toward a psychology of, well, you know, when I die, the world still continues, and I want to make sure that my grandchildren and great-grandchildren, who I will never even meet, have a decent world. And not just mine, but everybody else's. In other words, future generations. Franklin Roosevelt talked a lot about future generations. And then along came Reagan, and it was all about, hey, let's get as much as we can, as fast as we can, and to hell with the future. And that's why Reagan did away with free college education at the University of California when he was governor of California. Because he didn't care about investing in the future. And, you know, this thinking that Ayn Rand is quoted as saying, as I said, I'll have to play the clip for you tomorrow, where she says, when she dies, the world ends. Not just her, but the world ends. In other words, get everything you can while you're alive. You know, she's saying she's going to get everything she can while she's alive, because when she's dead, that's the end of it. No sense of commitment to future generations. Compare that, contrast that with the letters between Jefferson and Adams after their presidency, where they were talking about the legacy of America and their own legacy and the future generations of America, and how many centuries this nation might last. Or contrast that with the Iroquois Confederation's Constitution, which said that every decision made had to be made in the context of its impact on the seventh generation from now. In other words, people we will never know. And we need to be going back to that in America. We need to be, and this is why we need to be listening to the young people who are out with the Occupy movements, because they're saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, for the last 30 years, you guys have been running on Reaganomics, which is, to hell with the future, just get what you can. While you can. And we're the future, and we're here now. And it's not looking so good. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And this is why I think it's so great that when all those people showed up last night at midnight in Los Angeles and said, you know, no, we're going to back y'all down, it worked.
And if you just won't hear, you may be packing up next year, and we'll be biding our time watching Scotty go. To chat with us beside the fire, but he's a liar. That's our boy.
Yeah, that's Scotty Walker. That's the Watching Scotty Go song. It's amazing. Emma Sullivan, God bless her. Here's this high school. I'm assuming she's a senior. She's 18. Her text is Twitter is, and we are following her at Tom_Hartman. Is Emma Kate, EMMAKATE, 988. And she had tweeted last week that the governor blows, Governor Brownback, who, by the way, has said he does not believe that there's inherent right to privacy in the Constitution, has voted no to ban chemical weapons, was the only governor to attend Governor Rick Perry's prayer event back in August of 2011. Eliminated the Kansas Arts Commission, making Kansas the only state in the union without an arts commission. Favors teaching intelligent design. And in August 2011, was rejecting a $31 million grant from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to set up an insurance exchange. A couple months before that, he said he was going to take the money. Then he says he's not going to take the money. This is, you know, to set up for Obamacare. So anyhow, she tweeted, and apparently his office contacted the principal of her school and said this was not a respectful message. Governor Blows, come on. And so she was instructed to write an apology to him and submit it end of day today. And she has said, thank you, no thank you. Meanwhile, Los Angeles, what happened overnight was the deadline was midnight for Occupy LA to get up and move. And thousands of people showed up at midnight and they didn't get up and move. Apparently, that is ongoing. I'm looking at the LA Times. Occupy LA organizers plan to file for a federal injunction to prevent the dismantling. Protesters declare victory at least for another day. Villaraigosa won't say when the camp will be cleared. So we'll see how this plays out. But just the fact that it didn't happen last night says to me that these people movements are being taken seriously. Sanchez in East Los Angeles, you're in the neighborhood on the ground. Sanchez, what's up?
Well, one thing that I was happy to see, at least as far as the City Hall is concerned, you're familiar with the site of the City Hall, are you, Tom?
No. I mean, okay. You know, broadly speaking, I am, but I'm sure I have nothing close to your level of local knowledge. I'm here in D.C., you're in Los okay. Angeles.
Well, we have two large lawns, and those would be on the northern side.
Oh, you mean the site of City Hall? Yes, yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, I thought you said plight. Yes, I'm familiar.
Yeah, and there's no lawns between, like, the east and the western. All we have are the steps to get into the building.
Right.
And so the people congregate on the northern side and on the southern side. One of the problems that we were having was that gang activity began to produce itself with all the elements that gang activity attracts.
Right.
And that was one of the things that, because we are peaceful and nonviolent, these people came right in and made themselves at home, and it was no longer making itself, as we were trying to make it, a family-friendly environment. Even though we had a huge sign that said Kidsville, hardly any children would come with the adults, and the adults were very wisely trying to keep their children away from the other area, which was the south side, where this one group in particular was hanging out. And
right.
I didn't even like the fact that they were down there. There was an element I don't know about, and I really even hate mentioning it over the air, was a fact of missing funds from Occupy LA, and I asked several times about that. What happened to it? I would like to see the books about it, because I'm wondering where that money went to.
Right.
Now, when I mentioned that there are gangs in our south side and money begins to disappear, those two things I'm highly suspicious of. So at least in this case, the gang activity did leave, and hopefully more of them will leave, because it, again, these daytime activists, these cocktail activists that I've been trying to get to go down there, the people that say, oh, yes, we need something different in this realm. These people are the people that we need to be occupying
right.
down there.
Show up.
But when you have a group of other people that are being dropped off directly from the jailhouse, they take them in a little limousine from the jailhouse and then drop them right on the south side. That's the other thing that we're battling there, because of the fact that we are a unique amongst all the occupies across the country. Every other occupy situation does not have the approval of the police. So they're getting.
So wait a minute. Are you saying that the new strategy to cripple or weaken or damage the Occupy Los Angeles movement is to take homeless people or people who just got out of jail and dump them there and say, here, you know, free lodging, free food, free medical care?
Exactly. As a matter of fact, if you can believe this, Tom, I was being trained as an emergency medical technician. I went halfway through the training, but the person that was training us got so disgusted because of the fact that these people, these junkies, these people that were just getting out of jail and needed fixes, were being dropped off right next to the medical tent, and all they had to do was break in and get syringes or whatever.
Right.
This was done, being done deliberately by the LAPD. They were dropping off all kinds of people. Well, I don't want to say crazy people, but people that needed psychiatric help.
No, I understand. I understand.
They would drop them off and tell them that there's free food, just hang out here.
Yeah, apparently some of the police in New York have been doing the same thing with Zuccotti Park, sending schizophrenic homeless people down there.
That was the same plan. It seems to be a national plan, and it was troubling us. So we were a two-sided camp. The larger side, the southern side, is where you'd have the Burning Man, those rave-type guys that would come, they have blonde hair and blonde dreads and, you know, hardly clothed. They're all beating on drums and things like that. And on the north side, we had people reading Noam Chomsky. I was trying to read S. Brian Wilson's new book Blood on the Sands, Blood on the Tracks, but I never had a chance to read it because of all the other distractions that were going on. So as far as I'm concerned, I welcomed the raid, because at that point, most of those people, most of the undesirables, most of the people that were just lying flat on their butt when it came time to do marches, because, they were lazy. There's that element. I'm going to agree slightly to what right-wingers say about some of the homeless people or some of these layabouts that want free food and free welfare. It's true, because they were in that camp. They were sitting in their little tents. They were smoking their pot. They didn't go out any time to do any type of marching, any passing out.
Welcome to the, Sanchez, welcome to the messiness of movement politics and of America and of small-d democracy and of having an organized system that doesn't care well for, it was Ronald Reagan who stopped funding of mental health services and basically created this homeless problem that we've got in the United States. Let's send these people over to the Occupy folks. You know, yeah, I get it. And the how to work with this, how to deal with this and what to do about it is really going to be a challenge for the Occupy folks.
Well, one of our councilmen came out that morning and was trying to speak to us about everything. Well, we sympathize with your efforts, and we applaud our efforts here. But, you know, basically the bottom line was at 10:30, the park is closed and the cops are going to come and there's nothing we can do about it. So get out. That was basically how he towed his message to us yesterday on Sunday. I had to leave because I had certain pieces of artwork there that I knew were going to be damaged if the LAPD came along and, took everything away. So I had a car parked in a parking lot that was supposedly locked. It wasn't, two blocks away. And so I sneaked away carrying my things out. So all my things are safe. I can't say the same for other people, but over the overnight broadcast I was hearing from our local radio station, a public radio station, KPFK, was saying that, yes, the police were coming in. I don't know how many arrests were made at this point, but yes, the police were coming in and trying to clear the lower part of City Hall Park. It's the southern lawn, the larger of the two lawns, where there was always a regular farmer's market. And when the occupiers came in, we sort of kicked the farmer's market and upset the basic garden nature of the southern part of the park.
Right.
It's a smaller parcel of land on the north side. They had no issue with that. And as far as our neighbors on the north side were concerned, that's where all the intellectuals were. We had our library there. We had our People's University that was talking about some wonderful subjects that boggled my head. But anyway, all the good stuff was on the north. All the bad stuff was on the south.
Well, and maybe some of the bad stuff wasn't all the bad stuff. I mean, if we're seeing history repeated, like the history of the 60s, for example, the anti-war movement being repeated, there were a fair number of people in the anti-war movement who just wanted to get high, and they were there for the anti-war movement. And there were a fair amount, and I think, in older societies, they might have been the shamans among the group. I one of the things that always concerned me about the anti-war movement in the United States was the large element of Trotskyites, basically, who didn't see a spiritual component to what was being done. you know, just saw it in terms of cold, hard politics and Marxist, classical Marxist analysis. But, Sanchez, thank you for the update.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I think it was an absolutely compelling story. Talk Radio News will be up in just a moment. We'll check in, find out what's going on here in D.C. Yeah, they're the 99. We're the 99. And here's the amazing thing. The publisher of the Manchester Union Leader, Louise and I used to live in New Hampshire, and we used to get the Union Leader. Bill Loeb published it. This was when he was still alive. And he had these front page editorials and this big black box around them. And they were the most right wing. I mean, it was like stuff right out of the John Birch Society literature. And the Manchester Union Leader has endorsed Newt Gingrich. And when the publisher was interviewed on Fox, and asked, why did you endorse Newt instead of Mitt? Because Mitt is the guy that's probably going to be the candidate. And he said, because Mitt represents the 1%. And this is going to be an election about the 99% versus the 1%. Mitt is a private equity manager. He's one of the 1% guys. And I find that absolutely mind-boggling. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. On the line with us, brought to you by Self-Empowerment, Ellen Ratner's new book, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st. Victoria, welcome.
Thank you.
I see you are in the White House.
I am. I'm in the basement, indeed.
Okay. Yes. So what's up?
Well, very interesting. A federal judge did something surprising this morning.
Okay.
Well, he threw out the $250 million settlement between the Securities and Exchange Commission and Citigroup, Inc. over a mortgage bond deal. You may remember I reported on this a few weeks ago.
Right.
Well, he's previously been critical over the SEC's approach to settling securities cases. But what's interesting is why he rejected the pact and the scouring language he used. He says he lacks a framework for determining the adequacy of the deal based on the facts presented to the court. He said the SEC's longstanding policy, hallowed by history but not by reason, of allowing defendants to enter into consent judgments without admitting or denying the underlying allegations, deprives the court of even the most minimal assurance that the substantial injunctive relief it is being asked to impose has any basis in fact.
Now, is this the case that the Attorney General of California is threatening to blow up by not participating, or is that something separate?
Well, there are quite a few going on, so I don't know whether it is, but this one has been settled. This is the one where the SEC accused the bank of failing to disclose to investors its role in selecting underlying investments in the $1 billion mortgage bond deal, or that it retained a short position betting against the assets.
Right.
He said, this is worth reading, it's about 5 lines. In any case like this that touches on the transparency of financial markets, whose gyrations have so depressed our economy and debilitated our lives, there is an overriding public interest in knowing the truth. In much of the world, propaganda reigns, and truth is confined to secretive, fearful whispers. Even in our nation, apologists for suppressing or obscuring the truth may always be found. But the SEC of all agencies has a duty inherent in its statutory mission to see that the truth emerges. And if it fails to do so, this court must not, in the name of deference or convenience, grant judicial enforcement to the agency's contrivances.
That's remarkable.
It's quite remarkable.
So does this mean that the deal is dead and that the bank is then... And so now is the bank going to have to stand trial?
Yes.
And is it just one bank or is it a group of banks?
No, it's Citigroup.
Citigroup, just this one bank. But presumably if Citigroup is going to have to stand trial, then, I mean, we know that Goldman, for example, was betting against the derivatives that they were selling. I mean, that was all that bleepy deal stuff that Carl Levin was quoting on the floor of the Senate, if you'll recall.
Well, it rather opens up the can of proverbial worms. I must say, I was speaking to a friend of mine who's an investment banker who tends to side with the little guy on these things, and he said that the word on the street was very much that the SEC had been very lax in this case.
But apparently the federal judge is not going to let them be lax.
No.
So now does the hammer fall or do they just stop?
Oh, I think that they are going to have to go to court if they've got anything.
Right.
if they've got the goods on Citigroup, they're going to have to go to court. They have been doing sort of business as usual and just settling for $285 million. It's quite possible that they could get a lot more if they want to go to court. The thing is that Citigroup have got a bottomless pit of lawyers who are prepared to fight forever, and the SEC has got government lawyers.
Right, and an entire Republican Party committed to cutting their funding.
Precisely.
Yeah.
So it's a very, very interesting case. But you're right. There are other banks standing by who are probably going gulp at this.
It's going to be very interesting to look back at the roughly 2 p.m. Eastern time stock tickers and see what the bank stocks did.
Yeah, because they were up this morning because they were happy about the Thanksgiving sales.
Yeah. Yeah.
They may not be so happy about this.
Yeah, at least the bank stocks. What else is going on?
A UN report today documents serious gross violations of human rights by their security forces. It's the Independent International Commission on Syria. Quite extraordinary. High-ranking officers, this is since the crackdown, consistently across the country issued orders to shoot at civilian homes, unarmed protesters, including shooting at the upper body and head, records evidence of systemic torture and sexual violence against those in custody, including against boys, including killing hundreds of children, including, for example, a two-year-old girl. The officer in charge said that he killed her because he didn't want her to grow up to be a demonstrator.
Oh, my. And this is Assad's Syria.
This is Assad's Syria.
And Assad has now been abandoned by the Arab League, we should note.
Right.
So we'll see how long he can hang on in the face of this.
Right. This is really serious. Now, I asked Jay Carney today in the briefing whether, in the light of this report, is it not time perhaps to turn to the UN Security Council?
Right.
He did not, of course, answer me.
Right. And now Syria doesn't have much oil or any oil, to the best of my knowledge. So probably there's not going to be a NATO strike like there was in Libya.
No, I don't think so. Although the Arab League did say that the language, I don't remember the exact language, but it basically said that things were not off the table.
Hmm.
But the Arab League sanctions are not going to be completely effective. Lebanon, Jordan, and Iraq will not enforce the sanctions.
Iraq, our ally, won't enforce the sanctions?
That is correct, sir.
Oh, my. They are very much going their own way in a lot of things. We have created interesting times. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by Self Empowerment, Ellen Ratner's new book. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Jesse Ventura is up next. He has thoughts on the TSA and the 2012 elections.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, it's really remarkable how the Republicans, welcome back to the program, by the way, the Republicans across the country are afraid to talk to their constituents. They're afraid to meet with the voters, even their own voters. Increasingly, for example, in the state of Washington, there is this Congresswoman, Jamie Herrera Butler. It's spelled B-E-U-T-L-E-R. Don't live in her district, never heard an ad for her, so I'm guessing on the pronunciation. Maybe it's Butler. And she's a Republican from Washington State, and she's not doing public town hall meetings. Virtually no Republicans are doing public town hall meetings. But they do know that, you know, kind of part of their job description is to meet with the public and meet with the voters. So what she's done is she's said, well, let's have these private coffee clatches. She actually has a name for the community coffees, is what she calls them. And so she had one last week. She asked the local newspaper, please don't publicize it. You know, we can't have the riffraff show up, you know. The mobs. So please don't publicize. So it's invitation only. Registered Republicans only, people who voted for me and donated money only, or some variation thereof. And still, somebody who was in the crowd got up and said, why did you sign this pledge to Grover Norquist? What happened to pledging your pledge to the Constitution? Now, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution explicitly says that Congress, the House of Representatives, to be specific, Congress is given the power to lay taxes, to tax, and to spend, and to borrow, for that matter. But if you've signed Grover Norquist's pledge, you have signed a pledge, an oath, to not do what the Constitution says, you know, one of the many things the Constitution says you can do. To not do part of your job. And one of her constituents, Kathy Thompson, a real estate broker from Longview, Washington, said, I think this is totally un-American. I think your only pledge should be to uphold the Constitution of the United States. So let me just say to Ms. Thompson, who I don't know, the news story doesn't disclose, but I'm guessing is a Republican or she wouldn't have been in that meeting, good on you. Increasingly what's happening is Republicans all across the country are starting to say, hey, wait a minute. You know, who's our loyalty to? Is it to a multimillionaire lobbyist, Grover Norquist, who's representing people like the Koch brothers and you know, other billionaires who pay his way so that they don't have to pay higher taxes? Or is it to the people of the United States? And I think that Republican voters are getting it, that they've been duped. I find it just fascinating. You know, there's this loophole in the tax code. And this particular loophole is called carried interest. And basically, if you earn your living, let me back up. Let me give you the big picture here, the historical perspective on this. Because this is where I think that Republicans are starting to wake up. And the proof of this is what happened with the Manchester Union leader. Up until 1921, whether it was the income tax that Abe Lincoln put into place to pay for the Civil War, or whether it was the income tax that came into place in 1913 or 1916 or thereabouts, whenever we had taxes in this country, income taxes, regardless of how you earned your income, you paid the same tax rate. And the top tax rate in 1921 on people who earn their income by the sweat of their brow or the sweat of their arm, you know, whether they were out, you know, digging up streets or building railroads, or whether they sat in an office and did bookkeeping, however they earned their living, or if they earned their living as a capitalist, in other words, by loaning people money or investing in businesses and then getting a return from that investment. Capitalists earn their living with capital rather than with labor. Most people think that small business people are capitalists. They're not, typically. They're actually entrepreneurs. There's a difference. I've started and built up over my lifetime 7 businesses, 5 of them quite successful. I'm not a capitalist and never have been because I don't make my living off capital. Every single one of those businesses, we basically started from scratch, either with our own money or with, in one case, with a $10,000 line of credit from American Express. They were the capitalists, arguably. So anyhow, what happened in 1921 was President Harding was elected in the election of 1920, Republican. And the first of 3 Republican presidents over the next 12 years, Harding in 1920, the election of 20 to the election of 24, I guess it would have been, and then Coolidge, 24 to 28, and then Hoover, 28 to 32. These 3 Republicans. And Harding's campaign slogan was less government in business, more business in government. I'm not making this up. Go back, you know, Google Harding. And, you know, this was his campaign slogan. Less government and business, more business and government. In other words, let's run the business, let's run the government like a bit. Have you heard this song before? And one of the things that he, one of the conclusions he came to was that while it was fine to have a 68%, as I recall, tax rate for people who earn their living, you know, after they've made, I mean, it takes a hell of a lot of income to hit the point where you're actually starting to pay that tax rate. And you don't pay that tax rate on the first X that you earn, but, you know, after Y, then you start paying that tax rate. That was okay for people who actually work for a living. But if you earn your living as a capitalist, your maximum income tax rate should be 25%. So he invented this capitalist gains tax rate that basically didn't exist before then, where he said, you know, people who are wage earners, they're going to pay a higher tax rate. But people who are capitalists, people who largely fund Republican campaigns like Harding's, they'll pay a much lower tax rate, income tax rate. And we have had that capitalist gains tax rate with us ever since 1921. And ironically, the only time that it's been equal to the income tax rate was for about a year during the Reagan administration, when the capitalist gain tax rate was at 28%, and Reagan dropped the labor income tax rate from 74% down to 28%, so they were both at 28%. Well, that didn't last very long. Reagan realized he'd made a huge mistake. He raised the labor tax rate back up, and during the Clinton administration, the capitalist income tax rate dropped down to 15%, which is where it is right now. And carried interest is considered one of those capitalist gains forms of interest. So there's this guy, Steven Schwarzman, who's worth about $5 billion, $4.7 billion, who's sponsoring a fundraiser for Mitt Romney because he says raising his tax rate, raising the tax rate on carried interest from 15% up to the 36% that the people who work for him have to pay, his bookkeeper has to pay, his janitor has to pay, is the same thing as the Nazis invading Poland. I'm not making this up. And this guy is holding a fundraiser for his fellow venture capitalist, Mitt Romney.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Which is exactly why the Manchester Union leader chose to endorse Newt Gingrich rather than Mitt Romney, because Mitt Romney is one of these guys, and they don't think he can win because of it. It's Talk Media for the rest of us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And this is the, you know, I told you I'd share the clip with you tomorrow, but we got it. Jacob figured it out. He's our audio wonder worker. Sometimes he comes into work, you know, dressed in red, white, and blue tights with a giant S on his chest. For sound man. In any case, this is the philosophy that is driving the Republican Party and has been for 30 years. This is the philosophy that has been driving the libertarian movement ever since it was created. This is the reason why the Koch brothers fund the Reason Institute and the Cato Institute, the two principal voices of libertarianism in the United States. And this is an interview. It starts out with a little bit of setup from Adam Curtis. It's a documentary he did for the BBC. Talking about Ayn Rand and introducing the interview, and then it's an interview with Ayn Rand. And it's at the very end where the really important part is, where she talks about what she thinks is going to happen when she dies. Listen to this.
I kind of think of this whole thing as ongoing, that there is an eternity and that we are going to be a part of that eternity, that we aren't just corpses and graves when we die.
But we aren't corpses and graves. We are not there. But you understand that when this life is finished, you're not there to say, oh, how terrible that I'm a corpse. No.
Well, this is true.
It's finished. And what I've always thought was a sentence from some Greek philosopher. I don't unfortunately remember who it was, that I read at 16, and it's affected me all my life. I will not die. It's the world that will end.
You get that? She said she read this when she was 16, and it's affected her all her life. That she will not die, it's the world that will end. That was Ayn Rand. And that's the philosophy of get what you can right now and to hell with future generations that has been animating this movement ever since. And I find it just incredible. I mean, just, you know, not just incredible, wrong, profoundly and deeply wrong. So anyhow, Josh Hirsch is on the line with us. Josh is the correspondent for the foreign affairs correspondent for the Huffington Post and has been down in Tahrir Square. He is calling live from Egypt at this moment. And Joshua, thank you so much for being up at this, must be a fairly late hour there in Egypt.
Yeah, it's all right. It's been a long and sort of invigorating day here, actually. So
what's the status of things right now?
Well, we had an election today. It started early, a little bit late in a lot of districts, but more or less on time. And they just sealed up the ballot boxes. Although there's going to be a second day of voting, so they just sealed up the ballot boxes about 20 minutes ago across the city. And everyone is kind of looking back in wonder and marveling at what turned out to be a rather uneventful and seems like successful day of voting, at least logistically speaking.
Now, the outcome of this voting, could it be that the outcome of this voting will be that the military will lose their power over the state of Egypt, or is it simply there's going to be a new face on the old machine?
This is the ultimate question, and I could take up pretty much the rest of your hour trying to explain to you that.
Yeah, well, we got about 2 minutes.
Yeah, I won't do it. I promise you. But it's the nuances of this system are completely complicated, are beyond belief complicated. But this will introduce a parliament, and the parliament may actually be pretty strong. And if you look at the turnout today, which seemed to be by a lot of counts, sort of approaching 50%, which is
was there not an Egyptian parliament before now?
There was. It was a totally symbolic parliament. I mean, you're absolutely right. It was a symbolic parliament that just sort of hung around and filled the time.
They were the rubber stamps for what's his name, Mubarak.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's still a dynamic that people are working on trying to figure out. The military has professed not to want to play that role. They've shown some signs of playing it inadvertently or maybe intentionally. But it may be a little harder, you know, with a democratically elected parliament and all eyes on the country.
Right. Yeah. And so is it possible that we could see one of those situations that we saw in so many third world countries in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, where the military basically, you know, as in Thailand, I was actually there during one of them, where the military actually goes into parliament and says, okay, we're taking over.
I think we're pretty far from that at this point. I mean, you know, the military is pretty comfortable with the amount of power they have in the executive, essentially.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't really need to do that. We're pretty far from that. I think that people are hoping for something closer to the Turkish model here, where the military is quite powerful, but not, you know, overtly the
but not the ultimate power. Now, is there an election also for a prime minister or a president for somebody to replace the position that Mubarak held?
That's right. There will be. I mean, and this parliamentary election is going to carry on for about a month and a half across all the districts of the country. Mm-hmm. And then there will be a higher council election. And then at some point next summer, there will be a presidential election. That would replace the role of the military, theoretically. That's what mm-hmm. everyone's sort of crossing their fingers.
And the people will elect that person rather than parliament.
Exactly. That's right. There will be a prime minister, too. You know, these parliamentary systems have a lot of overlapping authorities.
So will the president be functionally a symbolic president, like the president of Israel, and then the prime minister will be where the real power is, or will the president be more like our president?
I think the president will be more like our president. I think that would be the idea.
Very interesting.
Well, we shall see. You know, it's people are optimistic today in a way that they haven't been in
Is Egypt a constitutional republic?
It is. Yes, it is.
So there's a constitution, and
there is.
And does that constitution address the role of
this parliament? Will actually be empowered to write the new constitution, which is a reason why, in some ways, this election is rather important for the parliament.
The military
has made a number of power grabs in recent months, attempting to institute sort of principles they've called them that will supersede the constitution, and that's
right.
been
or guide the creation of it. Fascinating.
Exactly.
Joshua, thank you so much for being so knowledgeable about this. Joshua Hirsch, foreign affairs correspondent for the Huffington Post, huffingtonpost.com/Joshua-HERSH. Thank you, sir.
I would.
Fascinating. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. Up next, the good, the bad, and the new vocabulary word, ugly. Be the good, the bad, and the very, very legatically ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good. Federal Judge Jed Rakoff. Today, Judge Rakoff nixed a $285 million settlement deal between Megabank, Citigroup, and the Securities and Exchange Commission, arguing that letting Citigroup just write a check to get off the hook for its high crimes is, quote, not in the public interest. In his decision, Judge Rakoff ordered instead that the case against Citigroup should go to a public trial. He wrote, in any case like this that touches on the transparency of financial markets, whose gyrations have so depressed our economy and debilitated our lives, there is an overriding public interest in knowing the truth. Well said. Let's put the banksters on trial. The bad. Bill Lumen, the Waco, Georgia resident. Maybe that's Waco, Georgia. In any case, the Waco, Georgia resident who owns the company U.S. Cranes just put in place a new company policy vowing to not hire anyone, until President Obama is out of office. He's plastered the message on the side of his company truck, too. Lumen, whose Facebook posts indicate that he is an Obama conspiracy theorist, Islamophobe, and Confederate sympathizer, claims he has people he wants to hire, but he won't do it, quote, unless some things change in D.C., end quote. I guess no one told Lumen that President Obama has offered several tax breaks to small businesses like his, including a $4,000 tax credit to hire long-term unemployed people and tax credits to hire vets, only to have those tax breaks filibustered by Republicans in the Senate. So much for people like Lumen being considered job creators. And the very, very ugly Liz Cheney. In an interview with GOP TV's Fox So-Called News, Cheney proved that, like her father, she's living on another planet. Referring to the president's economic policies, Cheney said, the president basically seems to have made the calculation that he's going to let the next 13 months of the American economy slide for the sake of his own political benefit. End quote. Exactly what political benefits there are for a sitting president to let the economy crash? Cheney didn't get into that. But in psychology, there's something called projection bias, and Liz Cheney just committed it. Basically, it's when someone denies their own thoughts and motivations by projecting them onto others, as in Liz Cheney is denying that she and other Republicans like Mitch McConnell support letting the economy crash to ensure that President Obama is a one-term president by accusing President Obama of doing the same thing. Maybe she could use a few more therapy sessions, because that's very, very ugly. That really is. By the way, Emma Sullivan has gotten an apology from Sam Brownback, the governor, former senator from Kansas, now the governor of Kansas, for talking to her principal's office. That's amazing. Ah, how the mighty have fallen. And down in Georgia, U.S. Bank did not want to modify this guy's loan, Mr. Phillips. And so the judge said taking $20 billion of taxpayer money was no problem for U.S. Bank. A cynical judge might believe that this entire motion to dismiss is a desperate attempt to avoid a discovery period where U.S. Bank would have to tell Mr. Phillips how his financial situation did not qualify him for a modification. So anyway, it got into a whole Arlo Guthrie thing, but we did that earlier, and there's a whole lot of folks who'd like to hop in here and offer their thoughts, so. Let's start with Brian in Asheville, North Carolina. Hey, Brian, thanks for listening on Main FM. What's up?
Hi, Tom. As a progressive, I would like for you to invite Ron Paul on for a weekly, hourly question and answer session, much like you do with the Brunch with Bernie, because I have a lot of questions I'd like to ask him. I'm sure a lot of other progressives would like to do the same, as well as some supporters on your show of Ron Paul.
Yeah. Ron Paul has been a guest on our program many times, and usually it ends up In fact, in every single case, it has ended up a debate between me and Ron, and he's good-natured about it. But the fact of the matter is that Ron Paul is perfectly willing to let Americans die if they're not born rich, to let them remain uneducated if they're not born wealthy, to let them live in squalor and destitution if they are born handicapped. And somehow, even though he himself is not religious, thinks that the religious people among us are going to save all the people in need in this country. And it's a fantasy. In fact, it's a sick and twisted fantasy. And so, bottom line, Brian, first of all, no, I'm not going to provide a forum for Ron Paul. Congressman Paul is always welcome on the program. And in fact, I think we've reached out to him in the last few months. And he just doesn't find this a particularly friendly venue for reasons that I think I just articulated. Calvin in Idaho. Hey, Calvin, what's up?
Hi there, Tom. I want to talk about banks and banking.
Yes, sir.
You've talked with Ellen Brown.
Several times.
And what's the idea I have is an Occupy National Bank.
Yeah.
Now, I've had a whole string of emails with Ellen Brown today. And she's willing to write about it and say how it would work. But what we need to find is someone who can pull it all together.
Well, I had a long conversation with her a week or so ago. If you go to conversationswiththegreatminds.com, you can watch the half-hour dialogue that we had.
I saw that.
Yeah, and she's been on this program a number of times. I strongly support Ellen and her worldview. Webofdebt.com is her website, and I agree with her. I'm not certain that a national bank is so much the way to go, although I do think that the Fed should be nationalized. So I guess that's the national bank, bring the Fed under the Treasury Department. But I agree with Ellen that each state should create its own bank, and those state-owned banks should compete with the commercial banks, and eventually they will beat out the commercial banks and for all but the speculative business. And, it's been working in North Dakota since the 19-teens. And it's the only state that has a budget surplus as a result of this, because that banking business is a very profitable business. Last year was 34% of all corporate profits in America were in the financial sector. It's a very profitable business. And if the profit from that goes back into the state treasury, then, you've got something that really works. So, Calvin, I'm all in favor of it. And, Ellen writes about it frequently. I refer you to her writings, webofdebt.com. Jackie in Huntington Beach. Hey, Jackie, what's up?
How are you doing, Tom?
Good. What's on your
mind? I wanted to talk about the man who spoke earlier about the Occupy LA.
Right.
And the problems that they were having with homelessness and gang members and, all the...
And junkies.
And, yeah. I think that that's one of the problems, is that we're not being inclusive, because if anything, that's the lower part of the 99%.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to, I mean, these aren't people that choose to be junkies. They're not people that choose to be homeless. They're not people that actually choose to be gang members in most cases. This is, like you said, Ron Paul, this is where the lot that they're born into in most cases. And it was kind of like, the young man was kind of like, a little bourgeois.
Yeah.
He's reading Chomsky. Oh, well, that's great. Well, this.
Jackie, I understand your point, but here's if Sanchez is not here to be part of this conversation, so I'll share my take on it rather than what I think his take was. And that is that yes, that's true. And those people are part of us. And in fact, I think one of the marvelous things that they did in Zuccotti Park is they embraced some of those people, early on. Some of the homeless people who came down to the area, they made room for them. People who needed medical services, they provided medical services to them. Where it became a problem, and this is what Sanchez was identifying, is when the strategy of the police changed from, we're going to beat the crap out of you and spray pepper in your face, to, we're going to, coming out of the jail every single day is a dozen, two dozen, 30, whatever it may be. Every day they're releasing people who have been serving, 10 day, 30 day, 6 month, the short term offenses for being junkies or for being gang members or for, or people who got into the system because they are mentally ill, but they're stuck in the criminal justice system in any case, as is the case of, I think the last stat I saw was something like more than a third of people in our prisons are identifiably mentally ill, which is arguably right. The main reason why they're in our prisons. And so what the police are doing, according to Sanchez, and I have no independent confirmation of this, although we heard that the same thing was happening in New York City in Zuccotti Park, and again, no independent confirmation of that. But what Sanchez said is that he was there and he saw that what the police were doing was, instead of just normally these people would, you know, walk out the front door of the police station, or if the police were in a really nice mood, they'd drive them to the local homeless shelter. Instead, they were driving them to the Occupy place and saying, they got free food in there, they got free medical services, have fun. And and if you're trying to do a political movement and you're being overwhelmed by numerically, I mean, this group of people that you and I are talking about that we agree is part of us probably represents somewhere between 2 and 5% of our population. But when they start becoming 20 or 30 or 40% of your population as a movement, and you don't have a lot of infrastructure to deal with them, it makes it unmanageable. I mean, it brings it down. And that's, you know, I believe that's part of the strategy. And that's what, you know, he was quite proud of himself for reading Chomsky. I'm proud of him for reading Chomsky. But, you know, I don't think that, you know, it might have come across as a bit bourgeois, but I think that the main point that he was making is this is a change in strategy and tactics by the police that we need to know about and we need to condemn, frankly. And then we also need to be working to build a structure and infrastructure that will accommodate those people. Jackie, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, if anything, this is just another classic and tragic example of how the most poor and needy among us are being manipulated by the system to their own disadvantage.
From the war against disorder.
Well, let's hope so. Barney Frank is resigning from the House, which I think is a terrible loss. The man is a genius, but he has promised not to become a lobbyist and just issued a blistering, we'll get into that tomorrow. And Kathy from Longview, Washington is on the line. Apparently, Kathy, I quoted you earlier on in the program. Do I have that right?
Yes, and one of my friends called me, so I thought, I'm going to call Tom.
Okay. I quoted you, and I thanked you, by the way. It was a favorable quotation. I hope that got passed along to you.
That was no problem. No, I had called the newspaper reporter as soon as I heard about her coffee shop and got him to the meeting, because of course the Daily News here had not heard about it.
Right. So let's set the story up. Your congresswoman is, tell me if I'm pronouncing this right, Jamie Herrera, is it Butler or Butler?
Butler.
Butler. Okay. Butler. And she's the Republican from your neck of the woods there in Washington State. And she had an invitation-only community coffee group instead of a town hall, and you were there. Did you? And I said on the air, I said, I don't know if Kathy was a Republican or not, but she was invited, so I'm assuming that you were. Was I wrong?
I definitely am not a Republican.
Okay.
And how it's not the invitations go out is she does some robocalls. I was later in the late afternoon and evening out to landlines and for a coffee shop that's going to be the next morning at 8:30.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So tell us the story. Tell us what happened.
As soon as I heard about it from somebody else contacted me, let me know about it. Then I called the newspaper and I called some other people to get there and was able to stand up and tell her my background. I'm right now a real estate broker, but by background, I'm an accountant. I've got a Master of Science degree in taxation. I remember back in the 70s when the top tax rates were 70%. Now they're half that at 35%. We're wondering why we don't have enough revenue.
Yeah.
And I told her that I thought it was absolutely un-American for anyone to sign this pledge to Grover Norquist, this lobbyist, when her only pledge should be to uphold and defend the United States Constitution.
And how did she respond to your saying that?
She gave a cute little wave of her hand kind of, and said that pledge didn't really mean much, and kind of went on to natter about how she would she wouldn't vote for increasing tax rates, she might vote to end some tax subsidies, and she touted that she had voted to end an ethanol subsidy, an ethanol loophole.
So were most of the people, there were about 60 people there, I understand, is that right?
Yes.
Were most of those people Republicans? I mean, had she organized this in such a way that she was basically with a largely Republican crowd?
I think that was the intention, but several of us made phone calls, so there were there was a good share of Democrats there, too. Mm-hmm. And later she was questioned again about from somebody else about Norquist's pledge and wondering if she knew that his goal is to starve the government, so it basically becomes totally inept. And she at that time said she really didn't know who Grover Norquist was, and she really didn't know what he stands for,
wow.
Yet she signed his pledge. And I talked with the reporter afterwards. I said, I thought my head was going to explode when I heard her say that. And he said, well, he thought probably a lot of heads exploding in that room.
Yeah, he said, in fact, we've got the audio of it. It was back, I think, in 2002, 2003. He was talking with Mara Lassen on NPR, and he said, my goal isn't to destroy the government. I simply want to shrink it down to the size, starve it down to the size where I can drain it, where I can fit in the drain in the bathtub or drown it in the bathtub, yeah. And
then she also said she does not allow lobbyists to influence her, yet she signed this pledge to this major lobbyist.
Right, which is the ultimate influence. Well, Kathy, good on you for standing up, for sharing, you know, with other people, getting people to your elected representatives meeting, and for standing up and speaking out. I honor that, and I thank you for doing it.
Well, thank you for everything you do.
And,
we really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. And thank you for calling into the program and sharing your story with us. It's great to hear from you. Thank you. Okay, here's Barney Frank. Barney Frank says, I will neither be a lobbyist nor a historian. Now, by saying he's a historian, he's talking about the $1.6 million that Newt Gingrich was given by Freddie Mac back during the boom to be a historian, because that way he didn't have to register as a lobbyist and have disclosure and pay fees and things. He says, my intention is to do some combination of writing, teaching, and lectures. And he decided to retire for a number of reasons, including the Republican majority's stranglehold on policy decisions, the prospects of a tough reelection, and a redesigned district that includes over 300,000 new constituents. This is a real loss to the United States House of Representatives. You know, losing Barney Frank. We'll see. We'll see how this all works out. Gary in North Dakota. Hey, Gary, we got a minute to the end of the show. What's up?
Well, the Republicans hate our state bank in North Dakota so bad that they're trying to starve it.
He really?
Used to write all the student loans in the area, and they made him stop doing that because they weren't charging extra fees or the rates that the other banks were.
Right.
And so they hate this state bank like you can't believe.
So, and that state bank in North Dakota has been one of the things that has helped North Dakota be successful and North Dakota's farmers and business people be successful for the last century. So they're actually, the Republicans in North Dakota, actually passing laws saying that the state bank can't issue student loans?
Yeah, they did that, you betcha.
Holy
and,
cow.
And like you said, they've been a boom for our state because of what is basically going on now is what formed the bank.
Right. Yeah, it was formed during the peak of the progressive era when the robber barons were running the show and the banks were scamming everybody. Gary,
yep.
Thank you for the call, and thanks for the information. I had no idea. That's sad news. Meanwhile, I know in California there's an effort to actually create a state bank. So if you live in California, you might want to let your member of the assembly know, your state legislator know, that you're in favor of California having a state bank, because, or any other state. But I know that there's an active movement in the state of California. I'm sure there are in other states. So a lot of good stuff out there and a lot of good stuff coming up. Up next, coming up tomorrow, I'll be talking with Newark, New Jersey Mayor Cory Booker about supporting Occupy Newark. This is a very fascinating relationship. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, show up, tag, you're it. Occupy something.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.